Morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, June 1st, 54 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning.
Good morning, and I hope everybody had a wonderful holiday weekend. As you know, we did see some storms around the Wasatch Back Park City. We mentioned that that would likely be the case here east of the Wasatch Frontier at times, especially Sunday, Monday, which it did come into fruition. But overall, it was a pretty decent Memorial Day weekend. And of course, temperatures were on the warm side of things. Of course, the start of boating season and whatnot out there as well. And today we're going to be mid-70s, 76 in Park City under partly cloudy skies for the most part. Then we start building in that heat that we talked about last week that would be coming into fruition. And we're going to get to 80 for the first time this season in Park City tomorrow under sunny skies. We'll keep the sunshine around here most of the week, and we'll be in the mid-80s by Thursday and Friday for Park City as the Wasatch Front looks at record-breaking heat Thursday, Friday as well. We'll stay in the 80s and on Saturday. Now, that's at that point we're going to start looking at maybe getting in some isolated storms into the Wasatch Back for both Saturday and Sunday as things start to cool off ever so slowly at this point in time, and a front starts to try to push its way in. But it's a gradual cool down, so we'll still stay in the upper 70s, even as late as Sunday into Monday, and we'll just want to keep an eye to the sky at that point with the isolated storms, though we're still several days out from that point. The key thing is that we've got summer activities now open. We've got the boating season going on. This whole week looks great coming out of the holiday. It's just going to get really, really warm in Park City.
Okay, Adam, thanks.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Later on in the hour, Executive Director of the Park City Sunday Market, Kate McChesney, with details on the opening of the 2021 market Sunday. Finally, Cheryl Fox, Director of Summit Land Conservancy, will be in. Stay tuned. Well, with 3 days remaining in the 2021 school year for Park City School District, an email from the district to parents says that they're looking forward to ending this year healthy and strong. Staff and students, the email says, will continue to wear face masks through the end of the school year, including at Thursday's graduation ceremony, June 3rd. Thursday, the district added that they are keeping in place those strategies that reduce the spread of COVID transmission, especially in the school-age population, which are not vaccinated, wearing masks, vaccination, distance, and sanitization. The Park City Education Association, the teachers union, also strongly supporting this message and encourages staff and students to continuing following all of the COVID-19 mitigation procedures that have made the year a successful one. Well, veterans and people looking to remember fallen soldiers took to Park City's Main Street yesterday to commemorate Memorial Day. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has details from the event.
We're walking down Main Street today to honor people on Memorial Day.
A group of about 20 people made their way down Main Street Monday afternoon, stopping by restaurants to share stories about friends and family who died while serving in the military.
So over my many years, unfortunately, I buried far too many of my soldiers, but the last one, we were still training, and this was a young soldier who was not killed in combat, but he was killed in a training accident.
That's veteran Doug Cherry. He served 37 years in the Army. He says he walked to remind people why the country commemorates the holiday.
For most Americans, this has really just become the start of summer. It's barbecue season. You know what? That's great, too. And I'm glad. Look, it's the start of my summer. But it's also time to take a few minutes and remember how we got here.
The event was planned by the Park City Post of the American Legion. Glenn Wright, who's also a Summit County Council member, is the adjutant for the Post. He spent 6 years with the Air Force, the last three as a captain. Wright says by walking along Main Street, they were able to give people an idea about what Memorial Day means for veterans.
For me personally, Memorial Day is not a happy holiday. It's probably the most difficult holiday of the year for me, because I have friends on the wall, and I have friends who died as a result of other activities in the military.
He says many of the veterans they remember don't die while actively on duty. He and others walking with the group chose to tell stories about military members who died in training or those who committed suicide after struggling with PTSD and survivor's guilt. The Legion normally holds a ceremony in the cemetery. Last year, that was canceled due to the pandemic. This year, there were still some COVID-19 concerns that kept them away from the normal event.
We didn't think it was going to happen, and it takes us a while to organize a cemetery ceremony. But we would have had to start planning the event at least in early April, and things were not that definite.
Wright says in future years, the event will return to its original location, but they might add a walking event through Old Town as well. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, the Summit County Council meets at 1:30 tomorrow to interview applicants for vacancy in the North Summit Fire Service District. Then we'll go into closed session until reopening again in work session at 2:30. And in the studio with a preview, I've got Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be here.
Yeah, we were just saying it's been a year since
it has been
face-to-face here.
Absolutely. And it's just exciting to be back. And, you know, we're going to be back to a live meeting that will also be hybrid, so it can be viewed virtual this week. Hopefully it will all work. Our staff has been working real hard on that.
Yeah. What are the challenges?
You know, the challenges are always with a new technology and a new method. You know, we've been meeting virtually for over a year. And we've got that system down, and our public is used to that. The council is used to it. Staff is used to it. Now we're introducing both live and virtual at the same time, and so it has different components to it.
Oh, okay. So just hoping that the audio is okay.
Well, we've been testing it extensively over the last 2 months to try and perfect it, and we think we've got it there. It also is a challenge when, you know, we meet in several different venues, and having all of those setups work in each place, hopefully the same, so that both staff and the public can use it the same way, that's an added challenge.
Okay. And then in terms of the council members, I mean, are they kind of expected to be at the meeting or?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that they're going to have to talk about is how they want to operate. And we really haven't done that yet. We wanted to see how this first test of this works. I think their ethic that they're discussing amongst themselves is that their expectation is to be live at the meetings. But, you know, this also offers the opportunity that if somebody is traveling for business or for some personal way, that they can still be at a meeting if they need to be.
Okay, taking a look at the agenda, we've got the Chamber Bureau report. Do we know much here? I mean, we're hearing that ski resorts actually may have had a better season than anybody thought a year ago.
Well, you know, one of the ways that I look at it is in TRT collections, and I know Jennifer Wesselhoff looks at it very similarly, and very strong TRT revenues compared to what we were expecting. However, if you look at the report, occupancy is still off from previous year highs. Average daily rate is still off slightly, not as drastically as the recession that we saw back in 2010-12 timeframe, but rate is still off. So we're going to have to track those things to see how they recover over the next year.
Okay. Let's see. Also, we'll get an update on the bike share program. The report says for this season, we're not adding any further bikes or bike racks?
Yep. So we did a big additions last year to several areas of the county. And so this year we're just taking an approach of the same service will be available. You know, our staff is really concentrating on the transit startup this year, so that's where their main effort is at. But you'll notice in the report also we're talking about enhancements to bike parking and standards for that. As well as offerings out to businesses and places to get bike racks installed so that the public can get involved in identifying where those places are that we need to have bike parking.
Okay. And so are you asking for suggestions here?
Or
you guys have kind of already done a survey?
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm already seeing some requests come in. For instance, the People's Health Clinic made a request, and it was actually a request to the city staff to install a bike bike rack. And then, of course, since it's a county facility, we have to sign an agreement to maintain that over time. But that tells me that the system is already starting to work and people are making those requests.
All right. There was also a design challenge out there. Where do things stand with that?
I think we're going to hear about that from Chris Putt tomorrow. I have not gotten the details on where that's at.
Okay. Then in terms of kind of the bike share, I mean, do we still have some issues with that? I mean, at some point we saw people taking them where they shouldn't be.
You know, I would imagine we are always going to see some of those issues exist with a system like this that is open to the public. You know, there was issues of there's age limits put in place, and sometimes those are violated. Where bikes can be ridden, where they can't, if they're taken outside of areas. A lot of those issues have been worked through and largely solved over the last 4 years. And, you know, the other part is that we're hearing that our vendor is fully staffed and already out there doing a great job maintaining the bikes. But as we know, as we get through this, further into the season, it becomes more of a challenge because the bikes do get used well.
All right. And then following up on the transit, we've got kind of 2 weeks into the soft opening of the micro transit. How's that going?
I have, you know, as we talked about last week, there have been issues that have come up around people using the app, the concerns about safety in regards to the drivers, things like that. Largely we're taking those one at a time with individuals as they're using the system. The first week it was reported that we had over 200 rides. I saw one drop off an individual in my neighborhood last night as I was walking around. So I think we're working through the kinks, and the company is working through the kinks, getting ready for that full integration with our new routing system come June 30th.
Yeah, one of the, I guess, complaints was that we've got 4 bike racks on the van, and yet we've got a passenger of 6. So a family of 6, 4 kids and 2 adults, not everybody gets to bring a bike.
Well, or, perhaps another vehicle is going to have to come to service that that need. So I think we'll work through those issues, and I'm sure our vendor will be looking at what the averages are around bike use and all that. We want to encourage that because that's fully integrating all of our transportation modes. And of course, probably helping somewhat with some of our trailhead parking issues as well. Those are the types of things that we're going to learn over this first season.
All right. And of course, with summer starting, you are getting an update on the trail access efforts. We're trying to educate the public. So any new changes or wrinkles there?
Well, I think what you're going to hear as I was reading the staff report is that Basin Rec is being very active in a campaign of being out there with their enforcement, doing mostly education with their enforcement still. And what we should be hearing about is whether they're seeing success from that or not. Because, our trails have been now open largely for over a month because of the lack of moisture. So they should have some experience to share with the council.
All right. And the regulation, has that been effective? It says that the report says that although controls on crowded areas like Robb Trail might just drive the congestion to kind of other areas or side streets.
Well, I think that was part of the point. And I know that's not a complete answer, but, disbursement was one of the strategies, was getting people to understand that there's other places that they can go than just the most popular place. And, obviously there's reasons why there's a most popular place. It's convenience, it's access, but it's also the quality of the experience that people are probably having on those trails. But part of this is getting people to recognize that there is a larger system out there that we can all access and disperse a little bit more.
All right. It looks like you're also looking at a proclamation to recognize what Park City, North Summit, and South Summit school districts did.
Yeah, if you look at the remarkable job that our school districts did throughout the pandemic of managing the spread of COVID, comparatively to a lot of places in the country, And within the challenges of what they faced. I mean, a lot of different opinions by parents, by students, and varying opinions across our county about how seriously this should be taken. And they still had to educate kids. That was the main focus. It was to provide education. And they tried a lot of different ways, perfected their methods, were very flexible. And I think that's something we do need to recognize in this community.
Okay. And at this point, I think just Park City School District in the county is the only district still in class.
That's correct.
With a request to wear masks, but they don't need to.
Right. You know, and of course, that's the school district's prerogative, and they're making those choices. And each school district has to make it based on what on the information they have, and that's what our system upholds.
All right, let's see, the ordinance on accessory buildings is back for a discussion and some council direction, but it's not noticed for a decision here?
It is not. I think the council has discussed this with staff a little bit individually in order to understand better where the council wants to go, and I think we're still a little divergent in some of our viewpoints. So we'd like to have another discussion with council. Maybe offer some more information that the council has been asking for along the way to see if that sparks any direction.
Yeah, one of those things that had been asked for was by Councilmember Chris Robinson, a review of the most egregious examples. Do we have that?
Yeah, we're gonna see some examples of, you know, and egregious is a judgment, right? But you know, the Planning Commission has faced some of these issues along the way. Certainly, the council has heard comments from the public about that, so we've gathered some of those examples together.
Okay, and looking at both use, setback, height, number of buildings, the lot coverage area of a building, I guess after today's discussion, how soon do you hope to have a return?
Well,
I
think it depends on kind of where the council directs staff to go. You know, there's a lot of different issues. And, you know, the other issue out there is that we currently have a temporary zoning ordinance that doesn't allow us to issue building permits on these or go through the process of getting these approved. And that's affecting people in their construction season this year. So there's pressure on the system to get something accomplished with this. I think the council feels like they do need to do something. We just need to advance that conversation.
Okay, because once they make a decision and put it into approval of code, that would end the TZO?
That would allow us to end the TZO, correct.
Okay, so there may be part of a building season left if that happens.
I am hopeful of that because it has affected some folks that were already in the process.
All right. Finally, just wanted to ask about the recreation impact fee facility plan. Last time we adopted an impact fee was back in 2015. The report says that the current fee without credits is more than $3,400. Are we proposing an increase in that?
Well, I think this is the first step in deciding what a new fee should be, is putting together the information with Zions Bank, our financial advisor, to make sure that we understand what is the facility need in the future that impact fees would support because of different levels of growth, and then you go back and figure out, you know, is that a level of facility need that the council can support, that the administrative control board can support. Then you go and look at the fees that need to be charged to us to achieve that.
So this is just within basin recreation boundaries? Or are we talking countywide?
No, basin recreation boundaries.
Okay. All right. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I don't have anything else today except to say that you guys have a great studio.
Oh, glad you could make it in. Thanks. That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, at last week's Park City Council meeting, city officials began to settle around a proposal for the Arts and Culture District that would cost the city some $65 million in construction costs. KPCW's Sean Higgins has the details.
The $65 million proposal heard on Thursday did not include the $19.5 million the city paid for the 5 acres on the corner of Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive in 2017. With the cost of land, the total amount for the project would be roughly $85 million. The proposal would include 60 units of affordable housing and would omit one of the buildings planned for the southern corner of the parcel, originally planned as a transit cafe and performance space. Costs would be further cut by building housing above other spaces and exploring more economical building materials. Councillor Max Doyle said it was the closest the council has gotten to a feasible plan since the discussions began nearly 1 year ago.
This is the most comprehensive and most accurate representation of our conversations to date that I've seen come back. Every time we come back, it seems like there's an element of sort of surprise or something. We've done this 8 times, and this one most accurately addresses what we've talked about to date.
However, there was still some trepidation around some of the details. Councillor Steve Joyce has been one of the most outspoken skeptics of the project, particularly of the financial model. He said he came around on a lot of his concerns Thursday night, but was still wanting answers on how the city plans to fill several of the buildings planned for construction.
So I like where you guys have gone on the financials. I think we're a lot closer to something that I can swallow. The one thing I don't understand, I need to get more understanding of how we go from two big shells to actual useful, productive space.
A suggestion to that problem was to meet with local nonprofits to see if they had interest in some of the space as meeting rooms or other offices. The Sundance Institute and Kimball Arts Center are already expected to construct headquarters at the site, but no concrete agreements are currently in place. Councillor Nan Worrell told KBCW that although other nonprofits showed little initial interest in the site, she has heard in recent weeks of a potential need from some of those organizations.
Recently, we've been approached by several nonprofits saying, hey, you know, we really could use that office space now. We really could use a space where we could all meet together, where we could have our board meetings or a conference room we could use or something like that. So we're willing to revisit that, and I think we're going to pull together a group of nonprofits to kind of explore that further of what really do they need.
Worrell added she believes the city is close to presenting a concrete plan for the Arts and Culture District to the public and encourages feedback as the discussions continue in June. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
And just a shout out to the Park City High School girls lacrosse team completing an undefeated season and then winning the state championship on Friday over Waterford with a score of 17-11. So way to go, girls. And boys lacrosse finishing a 17-3 season on Saturday, state runners up with a 20-13 loss there against Corner Canyon. Well, on Sunday, the Park City Sunday Market opening for the season. And in the studio with details, I have the executive director of the market, Kate McChesney. Good morning.
Good morning.
So since we didn't have a market last week, are we calling this the 14th or the 15th season, or do we know?
Right. I guess technically we would be in our 15th season, but I guess really, 14th, right? But we just kept on planning, so here we are. But we are taking the street for the 14th time.
And that was something, a hard decision a year ago where you had to come out early. I mean, you were like one of the first big events that just said, you know what, we can't do this.
Yeah, we thankfully a very supportive board and the couple of us that are full-time, we kind of sat down and said, you know, it's not just about us, it's about so many of the other vendors and everything. And we kind of we certainly weren't mind readers by any way, shape, or form, but it just started to feel not good. And so we said, let's rip it like a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
And, and then I even watched all summer long some of the events just kind of hold out and hold out and hold out. And, you know, Park City Municipal finally had to rip the Band-Aid on some of those. And we were thankful that we did it early. And then we could breathe. Yeah. You know, I feel like there was something to be said about just knowing we had made the right decision and then just being able to breathe.
Okay. Well, so we're open then every Sunday through the summer. We've got like a 3-week break here in August.
Yeah. What typically would be the Tour of Utah, which would be August 1st, and then, of course, the Kimball Arts Festival, and then the third weekend, the 15th, is our no-event weekend, which the city had put in place years ago, and it's just kind of a break for everybody in the area. So August 1st, August 8th, and August 15th, we are not on the street. But from June 6th to September 26th, we are on the street every Sunday, 10 to 5.
Okay. Are you having any market extensions, you know, later on?
The only day that we do a market extension is on the finale, which is September 26th. We go one more hour, which is kind of our encouraging for all of our vendors to come down and join us to listen to music, maybe have a beer or a Bloody Mary. And so it just gives them an opportunity for us to say thank you.
Okay. So in terms of this year's market, I mean, are there COVID precautions?
So we're definitely recommending that people wear masks, but again, we're on a public street and we're doing, you know, all sorts of public things. So we have some fun signs that say practice safe six, which is practice safe 6 feet, and then masking for a friend, but nothing that's required. But I definitely think that there might be some opportunities where maybe people will look around and say, oh, it's probably a good idea that maybe I put a mask on, you know, whether they're vaccinated or not vaccinated. And so we will have masks available. We'll have plenty of hand sanitizer everywhere. And so we're doing all the things. And then the first four markets, you'll see a decrease in our vendor booth space. And, you know, we'll kind of, with Michelle and Kimberly, we kind of will assess it every week and see what it feels like. And today I know that we're going to go and keep marking all of our booth spaces, but just spreading out. So the first 4 weeks will be down around 50 vendors. And so, which is, yeah, huge. Typically we have about 250 vendors. So you'll see, especially in the areas where you would feel a little tight, those areas will feel a little bit more open. So, but other than that, yeah, just hand sanitizer everywhere and fun signs.
Yeah. Do you have any openings left for vendors?
Our application right now is currently closed because we do have an overabundance of vendors. I think that people over the last year and a half got really creative. And so we have some really cool new vendors that, you know, probably didn't realize they were artsy or artists. And so therefore they found some new and creative opportunities for themselves, and so they've applied, and so we'll have them on the street. So we do have openings, but right now the application's closed just because we had so many. And when we finally got our approval from the city and then our approval from the county for our mass gathering, we looked at each other and said, oh gosh, we got to get these all done. So the application's closed, but it should reopen in the next couple of days. And that'll be for later on in the summer.
Okay. Can you tell us about some of the new vendors? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of?
A lot of youth vendors. So we have a couple really cool youth tie-dye vendors. And we've got, a couple of youth vendors that are now, gosh, they're not even that youthful anymore. But the same kids that do the lemonade and the same kids that do the coffee. And we've got some cookies and it's just all sorts of fun stuff. Of course, you're going to put me on the spot. And I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Yeah. But they're, we're really looking forward to a lot of the good stuff.
Okay. And then similar to former years where you've got kind of like the children's garden and the bands.
Right.
Set
so
up,
we'll
the
have.
Farmers market.
Exactly. So we'll have the farmers market right here by the post office. And then as well, that'll be a lot of gourmet foods as well. And then down on the main street, we have our regular vendors, and then all the way down at the bottom, we have our main stage music going from 10 a.m. till 5, and then performances in between, and then all along the street we'll have buskers, which are people that just come, pop up, and start playing, you know, all sorts of fun stuff. So we've got musicians, we've got magicians, some jugglers, dancers, yeah, a lot of really cool artists.
Yeah. And then the car-free Sundays.
Car-free Sunday.
So how does that impact you, or does it?
It doesn't necessarily impact us directly, but it's something that we have wanted and asked for a really long time. So I'm super excited to finally share the street with everyone. And, you know, one of the things that we've always encouraged, and the businesses on Main Street have had opportunities to have pop-ups and or to have sidewalk sales. And over the years, some of them really took a lot of advantage and would have every Sunday along with us. But now, knowing what they did last summer, I'm really excited to see the entire street programmed, whether or not it's being programmed from us or from the entire, you know, just from the business owners themselves. Super excited to share the street. So.
All right. I've seen some requests for volunteers. You still need some volunteers?
Always. Always, always, always. And even, you know, even though you do volunteer, we do have a lot of gifts for our volunteers, whether it be gift cards or just our vendors do a really great job of donating some fun stuff. And so our volunteers never go away empty-handed.
Okay. And then, I mean, what do you have to do in terms of a shift? Is it an all-day or a half-day?
Oh, no. It's whatever you want to bring to us. We're very, very thankful. And so, but the majority is either a morning shift, which is from, you know, 10 till 1. And that's always seated, always with shade, and, you know, just kind of listening to live music or checking IDs at the bar, or 1 to 5. But if there's something in between there where you can just come for a few hours, trust me, we have great opportunities to just come for a few hours.
Okay. In the past, you've also provided space for free to nonprofits. Is that happening again?
Absolutely, yes. So we have typically 3 to 5 spaces on Main Street that we'll have for nonprofits. There's a nonprofit set, nonprofit application, which is just on our website, parksillysundaymarket.com. And you just go online and you can pick, you know, whichever Sunday is good for you, whether or not it's maybe around a gala that you're doing or a festival or a donation or a fundraiser that you're doing. And so we'll get you a free booth space. And then as well, we have an email that goes out to 18,000 people, which then follows on our Facebook and then our Instagram, which is another 25,000 people. So we have free marketing for that as well. So, you know, we'll have your link and, you know, a little write-up about it. So, yes, we do also free booth space for Historic Main Street Alliance. So any of the stores or even restaurants on Main Street can come and have a free booth. And then Park City Performing Artists Association gets a free booth as well.
All right. So are those all taken at this point?
I think later in the season we have some openings. Okay. But either way, just apply and then we'll fit you in somewhere.
Okay. And then volunteers as well, they just go online to...
Yep. Everything's online. Or they can call me. I mean, my number's listed everywhere. I'm the information hotline, 435-714-4036. And I do answer my phone. I'm very proud of that sometimes.
Right. And then in terms of the music lineup, is that also all online?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Brian from Mountain Town Music does an amazing job of booking our main stage and our farmer's market. And then any performers or dancers or buskers goes through me. But, yeah, I know this coming Sunday we're opening with Swagger, which is a huge, everybody, I'm so excited myself. Just live music. Oh, my gosh, we're going to be listening to live music together.
All right. And in the past, Silly Market has also taken on the organization of the Park City 4th of July. Are you doing that this year?
We are, yes. We had solidified that contract with them probably back in February or March, and not even knowing exactly how it was going to look, but still knowing that we're planning something. And so we're looking forward to hosting the parade on Friday. And then as well, we'll do fireworks on that Sunday night. And so that'll be the 4th of July. And then I know that I was talking to the event staff, and they're just kind of giving me what they're looking for as far as maybe music being lined up as well on Saturday. So it's a full 3 days of programming. But we had already planned, because we knew, right, the 4th of July was going to fall on a Sunday. We knew that years ago. And so it was already part of our contract for 2021. So we had a plan to do the whole shebang on the 4th. And so we were going to do the parade. We were going to, I know, just so you know, Leslie's looking at me like I'm crazy. But we did. We had it all planned out. And, you know, I mean, it would have probably been, you know, knowing what we know now, we say to each other, oh, my gosh, that sounds crazy. But 2 years ago, you know, prior pandemic, it was just 50,000 more people on Main Street. And we didn't think anything of it. So... But, you know, we do. We have a really good plan going into this coming 4th of July, and it'll be great.
Okay. Hey, anything else you want to tell us?
No, just remember all the usual things, right? Bike, take the bus, or walk up to Main Street. We will still have the bike valet at the bottom. And but just, you know, come and enjoy, and, you know, just be ready for another amazing summer in Park City.
Okay.
Going to get to a little bit of normalcy.
All right, June 6th, September 26th.
Yeah, yes, June 6th, 10 a.m. Here we go.
Okay, Kate, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Kate McChesney, again, Executive Director of the Park Silly Sunday Market. In the studio with me now, I've got Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of the Summit Land Conservancy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you have some good news. Still some time to go, though. You've got more than halfway through your fundraiser to save the Huntsville Monastery?
The former monastery property up in Huntsville, that's right. This is 1,000 acres that we're putting under conservation easement. The Summit Land Conservancy is working in partnership with the Ogden Valley Land Trust, which is an all-volunteer organization based up there in Huntsville. And so we together have been working with the landowners to put this this farm under conservation easement, preserve it as a farm, is the way the monks have used it for all of these years. So we got a large $8.8 million federal grant that will cover the majority of this conservation easement purchase. And then we needed to raise another $300,000 from the community. At this point, we're about halfway there on that $300,000, and we need to raise the remaining it's a little less than $150,000 now, but by the beginning of November. So we've got a little time on that, but we're working through that, and that's very exciting. So, you know, if people remember going up and visiting the monks, you could, you know, they had a little gift shop, then they sold honey and bread and things like that. And these were, you know, Catholic monks. And many of them, well, not many of them, but a few of them are still alive, but they are not able to live on their own anymore. So they're in an assisted living facility down in Salt Lake. But this is really exciting, and it's a fun project for us because it's great to be in partnership with the Ogden Valley Land Trust, working together to preserve this really iconic property.
Yeah. Any idea how many land trusts we have in the state?
7, which is really less than a lot of it. Like Colorado has 45. Wyoming and Idaho each have about 12. So we really have far fewer conservation organizations than the surrounding states. There are over 100 land trusts in Connecticut.
Yeah, but they don't nearly have the federal land that we do.
That's right. But, you know, one of the interesting things, and if you've heard about the 30 by 30 that the president is talking about right now, saying that we need to save 30% of the U.S. land mass by 2030 if we want to avoid a mass extinction event. In order to hit that target, we're really going to have to talk about private land conservation, which is what's happening with the Huntsville Monastery and the things that land trusts do, because we work with landowners for voluntary conservation. Many of the most biodiverse landscapes are actually privately held because those were the places where there was water, especially in Utah. So it's really important that land trusts have resources to work with landowners who want to see their properties protected.
Okay. You're also working on a new 6,000-acre easement?
That's right. That's in Morgan County. And this is a landowner who's been practicing regenerative farming and ranching and is interested in a conservation easement. And this also was somebody who was introduced to us through our friends now at the Ogden Valley Land Trust. And so we're working together on this easement as well.
All right. Because it's just an outright easement, then you don't have to raise money. They'll just take the tax write-off?
They'll just take the tax write-off. I mean, we still, and the reason that, you know, we're involved in this is a conservation easement, you know, there's a lot of legal documents that need to be prepared, as well as a baseline study, which requires biological knowledge and things like that. And that's what the Summit Land Conservancy staff does. So we are doing that in this situation. And normally those costs, those expenses, are part of our project budgets. In this situation, there's no project budget because it's being donated. So this is just, you know, a service that we provide in this situation so that this landowner can preserve these acres.
Okay. What's the latest with the Mountain Spa property there in Midway?
That's exciting because that is coming to a close, we hope, in the middle of July. So we are moving forward with the open space committees to make sure that we've met all of the requirements that they have for the open space money. So that's the Wasatch Open Land Board, Wasatch County funding, as well as the Midway Open Space Committee. And their concerns mostly were that there was water, and that, of course, was our concern too. And we're going to put conservation easements on about 40 acres of the 75-acre property, and then those lands are going to be sold to people who will have a building envelope and then have this conserved, basically, pasture or farmland as well. So if people are interested in owning some farmland in Midway, they should probably let me know sooner rather than later.
Okay. And then you're also working with the city of Hebert to put an easement on some of the Sorensen property, huh?
That's right. So this is a big, big development. This is the 8,000-acre Sorensen project that has been annexed into the city of Hebert. And there are about 5,000 acres of public open space associated with that annexation. And the city of Heber and the developer have agreed that putting a third-party conservation easement on that open space is a good idea. So we've seen other situations where we've relied on development agreements to protect open space, and that is a shaky protection, just to put it mildly, because development agreements can be renegotiated or overturned or taken to court and things like that. A third-party conservation easement held by a land trust like the Summit Land Conservancy is the best tool we have nationally for protecting open space. So again, in this situation, we don't have to raise money for this, but the Summit Land Conservancy, we feel like what we're doing in this situation is coming in and basically ensuring the public benefit of this big development.
Oh, that's interesting. So are there other places where you'd like to go back and replace development agreements with conservation easements?
You know, there are places where I think it would be a good idea to look at what tools were used to protect open spaces and evaluate whether or not we think those are strong enough. You know, when you will remember the Flagstaff Development Agreement, which approved all of Empire Pass. When that agreement came through, one of the concessions, if you will, that the developer made was they did actually put 900 acres under conservation easement up in Empire Pass. So all of like Daly Chutes and areas of Flagstaff, all of that is under, we hold a conservation easement on that. And that's a good thing, right? Because otherwise people would be coming back saying, gosh, it would be great to have another set of condominiums up here. Or if we could expand the houses over there. So, you know, at the time, they didn't put a conservation easement on Richardson Flats, which was also part of that same agreement, because at the time, you know, that was thought to be possibly a golf course or things like that. And, you know, over the years when they realized they couldn't put a golf course there because you can't water that land. Anyway, you know, the development agreement supposedly protected it as open space.
Okay.
Supposedly.
Yeah. Right, and now it's right. Talking about developing it as part of the Hideout annexation.
A portion of it, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, let's see. You've got a bunch of outdoor summer activities happening?
We do, and we're running our summer camps. Those are mostly sold out. We're going to run the same, what we call the sort of COVID-adjusted curriculum, which means we're not putting kids in any vans or buses and taking them places. So it's all outdoors. But we are increasing. Last year we would only have 10 kids per camp. We've raised that to 12, which is our normal number of kids per camp. And then other activities that we usually have during the summer to help people get outside and play. And all of those can be found on the Summit Land Conservancy's website at wesaveland.org. Click on the Happenings tab.
Okay. Anything else?
You know, this is such a beautiful time of year with the wildflowers blooming. I hope people really get out and appreciate the open spaces that we have that make our lives so lovely.
Okay. Cheryl, we'll see you next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Park City Council last week zeroed in on the Clark Ranch property near Highway 189 as a potential future site for an affordable housing project. That's US 40. However, there are quite a few steps that need to be taken before that could become a reality. KPCW's Sean Higgins has details.
In addition to the Clark Ranch, City Council also reviewed the city-owned land known as Mine Bench on Marsack Avenue below the Stein Erickson and summer property south of the rail trail. At the end of the discussion, Clark Ranch emerged as the best candidate at the moment for a future affordable housing project. Thursday's discussion was to determine if affordable housing at any of the sites was something the council wanted to pursue, which is only the first step in the process. City Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieter said each of the properties has its drawbacks.
Park City has done all the easy ones. These all have hurdles. They'll all have a lot of questions. You know, at the end of the day, Jason and I assume Rebecca and executives are looking for a head nod of how much you want to prioritize us working on these.
In the case of Clark Ranch, the city purchased the 344-acre property on the eastern border of Park City in 2014 in order to preserve the land as open space. If anything were to be developed on the property, the land would first have to be annexed into Park City, then be rezoned to allow for construction. Affordable Housing Manager Jason Glidden said the city always intended for some portion of the land to be used for more than just open space.
When the city did purchase this, they had always talked about carving out a portion of it for some kind of public use. In addition to that, it is right next to the Park City Heights development that is being currently developed right now.
In addition to annexation and rezoning, accessibility and topography will also have to be examined. Councillor Steve Joyce was part of the process when the city first purchased the land. He said although 10 acres was originally written down for potential public use, that number was actually quite arbitrary and would like to see a deeper feasibility study take place in order to determine just how much of the land is suitable for housing.
I would like to have somebody, when they're looking at it, kind of go, here's where it's easiest, and that's 8 acres, and here's where it's a little harder and you'd have to start working up the hill and whatever, and here's where you'd start getting into your steep slope rules for the city. And so rather than having somebody go off and look at 10, I'd rather them go off and start at that point and figure out where to naturally stop.
For the Mine Bench and Summer properties, the door was not closed entirely on future use, but the council made it clear the Clark Ranch would be their top priority going forward. Park City also has plans to build affordable housing at the site of the proposed Arts and Culture District at Bonanza Park, the Homestake parking lot, and Woodside Avenue. The city has a goal of building 800 units of housing by 2026. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, Summit County Council members say that they will resume deliberation on a proposed ordinance governing campgrounds and seasonal RV use at their meeting June 30th. As KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, a hearing on May 26th brought out a lot of criticism, but several council members are resolved that a problem exists and they have to respond.
Although the problems of trailers and campgrounds have been mentioned in areas like Samant and Weber Canyon, the bulk of comments at the public hearing came from owners in Manorlands near the Mirror Lake Highway. County Council Chair Glenn Wright told KPCW that most of the public comment was in opposition. About a third, he estimated, was for the ordinance or suggested changes to it. While some of the speakers said they can work with their owners' association to figure out a solution, Wright said they haven't done that so far.
From a legal standpoint, trailers, RVs are not permanent structures and can only be occupied for at most 6 months on a property. Essentially, that's what's happening, but our concerns are overcrowding in some areas, lack of water and sewer in some of the lots. And while some of the opponents of the ordinance said, oh, that's not happening, actually, one of the last two people that spoke to us last night was opposed to it, and they had just bought the property and intended to use it as an RV parking place for themselves, and they found they had that land they bought was covered with black water when they arrived, and they had to clean it up.
After the hearing, Council Member Chris Robinson said he'd like to get more information on the neighborhoods near Highway 150 and their associations. But he said that Manorlands was reportedly approved decades ago as a cabin area, not a neighborhood for trailers.
We approve a residential subdivision, and over time, I'm going to call it trailer creep, over time it's become a big deal. Maybe there are ways that they can govern themselves, but if we understood what the existing private rules are, i.e. the CCNRs, and what the existing documents are, the plats and other things, if there really are HOAs that think they can lead, then maybe there's a way to have a trial period here. Let's see if they can regulate their affairs on their own. I'm sympathetic that everybody views this as a taking or something, that we're the big bad old government's coming in, but it seems like it's a situation that through neglect has been abused.
Councilmember Deb Clyde said Manorlands has morphed over the years into an area that's breaking all the rules.
We have a subdivision here that has allowed its land use to get out of control to the point where we are creating significant health, safety, and welfare issues in every aspect that you can think of. This project breaks all the rules, and it breaks all the rules of proper land management, proper life safety, proper water quality protection, fire department access, everything. absolutely everything.
However, Councilmember Roger Armstrong asked just what are they regulating and how would they enforce it?
I wasn't saying we shouldn't regulate. I was saying, okay, you pass your ordinance, what happens Tuesday?
Armstrong told Clyde that they're seeing possible problems or actual problems in areas closer to home, such as Old Ranch Road or Silver Creek.
There's a property I know of in Silver Creek where they've got five massive trailers.
I concur with you. They're all illegal. People are living in those trailers. It's illegal.
Need to send out enforcement for that.
Are we always short on enforcement? Of course. But yeah. Are we going to have to do more in the future? Yeah.
Councilmember Doug Clyde, who said he's fairly confident the new ordinance is the right course of action. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
And the Summit County Council last week also gave an informal nod to two compensation proposals for their staff. One stems from last year's COVID belt tightening. The second relates to staffing challenges that the county is facing this year. Summit County Chief Financial Officer Matt Levitt and Human Resources Director David Warnock recalled that last year's scheduled merit increases went out to less than a third of their staff before the payments were suspended in March. They proposed restoring the 3% merit increases to the employees who missed out. The cost there about $529,000. The second proposal, as Warnock explained, is a 4% cost of living increase for all employees, costing about $927,000. Warnock said the county, like many other employers across the nation, is facing challenges in retaining and finding staff.
We're not getting as many applicants for our positions, and in some cases, applicants that we have made offers to have declined because of the housing market, or they declined it because their current employer has offered them an alternative wage to what we've offered them, or they found another job that pays more. So we're filling this labor shortage and feel that we need to increase our salaries in order to hire, retain, recruit, some candidates for our positions. We're noticing it's taking longer to fill our positions.
Yeah, Councilmember Glenn Wright said they're hearing that the county is also seeing an increase in turnover.
We had 17% turnover in the last year, and that is not a sustainable number. Having that much turnover, you have to go out and recruit people at a higher salary to fill those jobs. We are much better off trying to sustain our staff. It's good for the staff, and it's better to sustain the staff. You know, really, the ideal is to have people progress through the system, eventually retire, and replace a retiree with a newbie in the bottom of the salary scale. And I think that is both good for employees, and it's good for our budget.
The total cost for both measures comes to about $1.45 million. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher is scheduled to come back to the council with a 2021 budget amendment.